Today is Tuesday, September 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, tensions as North Korea fires off another missile.
We are just building up our national defense in order to defend ourselves and reliably safeguard the security and peace of the country.
Plus, partial U.S. government shutdown looms.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Monday blocked a Democrat bill which aimed to raise the country's borrowing limit, setting the chamber on a path towards government shutdown.
Also, German lawmakers begin search for a new chancellor. Our top story today is in the Korean Peninsula. North Korea fired a missile into the sea off its coast on Tuesday, South Korea's military said. The launch comes as Pyongyang has called for the United States and South Korea to scrap their, quote, hostile policy, unquote. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
North Korea fired a missile off its eastern coast on Tuesday. That's according to South Korea's military. And Japan's defense ministry said it appeared to be a ballistic missile, but gave no further details. The announcement came just before North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, Kim Song, urged the U.S. to give up its hostile policy towards Pyongyang.
We are just building up our national defense in order to defend ourselves and reliably safeguard the security and peace of the country.
North Korea has accused Seoul and Washington of double standards, saying they denounced its weapons development while continuing their own military activities. The North and South have been developing increasingly sophisticated weapons, and back in September, both test-fired ballistic missiles. Washington condemned the North's September test and a separate launch days earlier. Experts said that may have been its first cruise missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, a threat to its neighbors. At the same time, Washington did not mention Seoul's test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile, also fired in September. In a statement on Monday, the U.S. military said the latest missile launch posed no immediate threat to U.S. personnel or territory or U.S. allies.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on Tuesday said that authorities will, quote, more than ever heighten alert and surveillance, unquote, after North Korea fired a missile off its east coast. Suga said the launch, quote, could possibly be a ballistic missile, unquote, and that authorities are still analyzing the situation. It is still unclear if the projectile landed inside Japan's exclusive economic zone, or EEZ. Japan's Jinji News, citing government sources, said the possibility was, quote, low, unquote, that it landed inside the zone. Earlier this month, North Korea fired two ballistic missiles, both of which the Japanese government said fell into its EEZ. South Korea's defense ministry on Tuesday expressed regret over North Korea's latest missile launch. A spokesman said the ministry is analyzing the situation of North Korea's missile launch. A State Department official Tuesday said the United States condemns the missile launch and that it violated several UN Security Council resolutions. A sharply divided U.S. Senate failed on Monday to advance a measure to suspend the federal debt ceiling and avoid a partial government shutdown as Republican lawmakers denied the bill the votes necessary to move forward. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
Cloture vote.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Monday blocked a Democrat bill which aimed to raise the country's borrowing limit, setting the chamber on a path towards government shutdown. The legislation sought to fund the government through the end of the year and suspend the federal debt ceiling through the end of 2022. Senate Majority Leader and Democrat Chuck Schumer switched his vote no in a move that lets him call for another vote. He warned Monday that a potential default, the first in the nation's history, could devastate the economy.
The Republican Party has now become the party of default, the party that says America doesn't pay its debts. Our country is staring down the barrel of two totally Republican-manufactured disasters, a government shutdown and a first-ever default on the national debt.
Republicans have said they want Democrats to lift the debt limit on their own in protest against their spending plans, while Democrats say that much of the nation's new debt was incurred under Republican President Donald Trump. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell tried unsuccessfully to force the chamber to vote for a funding extension, separate from the measure that would suspend the government's debt limit. Monday's impasse comes as Democrats face an internal party debate between moderates and progressives over a $1 trillion infrastructure bill and a $3.5 trillion social spending package. Democrats now have just a few days to figure out how to keep the government running after current funding expires on Thursday.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. No representative from Afghanistan addressed the UN General Assembly in New York after the ambassador for the former government withdrew his name from the list of speakers. The move comes after the Taliban asked to have their own representative speak at the General Assembly. The elected government of Afghanistan was overthrown in August. For more, International Edition's Jackson Vunganyi spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir about this and other diplomatic activity as the UN General Assembly enters its final week.
Most journalists, we expected Afghanistan to really be the dominant issue because so much is happening there at the moment and leaves so many regions in a quandary about what's going to happen. Central Asia, the Russians are worried. South Asia is worried. The neighbors, India, Pakistan, and further afield, countries are worried. So we really expected that to dominate. But in the end, it was really this spat that France was quite upset with the U.S. in particular, but also with the Australians and the British over this deal, this new strategic partnership called AUKUS, Australia, UK, US, in which the Australians have decided to buy US nuclear submarine technology. And in doing so, they've basically broken a deal they had with the French to buy diesel-powered submarine technology from them. And so not only is this costing French tens of billions of dollars in a lost contract, but it's really bruised their ego. And they were telling anyone who would listen last week, basically, that it has really dented their trust in some of the other partners in the NATO alliance. So there were calls towards the end of the week between President Biden and President Macron, telephone call. There was a face-to-face meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Blinken and Foreign Minister Le Drian, which seemed to have gone a long way to mending fences, but they say that there's still work to be done.
Speaking of Afghanistan, when we last spoke, the Taliban had requested to have their representative speak at the UN General Assembly. How did that play out?
We were expecting them on Monday to be one of the last speakers and take the floor, but over the weekend, the Afghan mission here in New York notified the UN that they were withdrawing from the debate and that they wouldn't be speaking. So the mission here is represented by Ambassador Ghulam Azizai, and he was appointed by the previous government, but he still holds the credential. And the Taliban had sent a letter to the UN Secretary General about a week ago saying that they want their interim foreign minister to participate at UNGA, and they were replacing Ambassador Azizai. But they really can't do it yet because there's UN General Assembly committee that needs to review this request, and they won't meet until earliest next month, possibly not even till November. We were expecting Ambassador Azizai to speak. I mean, he had said he was going to speak, but he withdrew his name. So something has happened in the interim, and I imagine it will start playing out here over the next few weeks as they have a showdown looming over who will control that seat. Because let's not forget also the Taliban, nobody has internationally recognized government in Afghanistan yet.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with my colleague Jackson Vunganyi from New York. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan did little to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan. Anita Powell reports from the White House on how President Biden, fresh from a historic meeting with India's leader, is approaching relations with the two South Asian rivals.
A new era for the U.S.-India relationship, with a historic meeting between the two nations' leaders. In a joint statement, they described the meeting as a partnership for global good.
I think that the relationship between India and the United States, the largest democracies in the world, is destined to be stronger, closer, and tighter, and I think it can benefit the whole world.
But what about Pakistan? The nation is wedged between its arch nemesis, nuclear-powered India, and volatile Afghanistan. In recent weeks since U.S. withdrawal, thousands of desperate Afghans have fled to Pakistan to escape the new Taliban government. As U.S. President Joe Biden met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Friday, Pakistan's leader took to the world stage at the U.N. General Assembly to ask that very pointed question and to accuse the U.S. of hurting Pakistan during its 20-year conflict in Afghanistan.
There's a lot of worry about use in the U.S. about taking care of the people who helped them, the interpreters and everyone who helped the U.S. What about us? The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition in the war against Afghanistan.
Those remarks are likely to inflame tensions between the U.S. and Pakistan and between Pakistan and India.
It's clear that the Biden administration has lost patience with Pakistan and its leadership, which it feels has played a double game over Afghanistan, pretending to be an ally, but actually supporting the enemies of the United States.
VOA asked White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki why the leaders of the U.S. and Pakistan have not met face-to-face, especially after Biden last week vowed to embrace what he called aggressive diplomacy.
We have been in touch at very high levels with leaders in Pakistan, from the State Department, from the Department of Defense, and from other key components of the administration. The president has not spoken with every foreign leader at this point in time. That is absolutely true. But he, of course, has a team, an expert team deployed to do exactly that.
And analysts say such a high-level engagement may not be productive.
For the Biden administration, having a call with Prime Minister Khan wouldn't necessarily get anything done in a substantive way. The other reason, though, why I think that we haven't seen this call between Biden and Khan is that the U.S. has long looked at its relationship with Pakistan through a transactional lens. It's a very transactional relationship. And I think that U.S. officials would not want to give Pakistan the privilege or the pleasure of a call between Imran Khan and Biden just for the sake of having the call.
Sheikh says Pakistan has only one interpretation of the U.S.'s new coziness with India.
This is a zero-sum game for Pakistan. Moving towards India can only mean one thing, and that is moving against Pakistan.
These meetings heralded a new phase in U.S.-India relations, with Pakistan, it seems, watching from the sidelines. Anita Powell, VOA News, at the White House.
Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan sought to cast his country as the victim of American ungratefulness and an international double standards in his address to the United Nations General Assembly. He was indignant about what he described as American abandonment of both Pakistan and Afghanistan and urged the international community to strengthen the current Afghan government. As in years past, he decried India's Hindu national government and its management of Kashmir. Despite the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, tension is still rising along the borders of the two nuclear-powered neighbors. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaur.
Pakistani leaders have been pressing Washington to help mediate tensions between Pakistan and India. That has been stated policy of Pakistan for years because it believes that the United States is a country which can really influence India to help bring down tensions in South Asia. And that's why when Prime Minister Imran Khan of Pakistan addressed the UN General Assembly last week, he recounted the kind of tensions Pakistan has with India and also once again demanded that the international community help resolve the dispute of Kashmir, because that has been the primary source of tensions between the two countries.
How would you characterize the current tensions or relations between India and Pakistan?
Because of the dispute over Kashmir, tensions have remained there for decades. But in August of 2019, India unilaterally changed the status of its part of Kashmir and made its part of Kashmir as a union territory. And that's what Pakistan seriously and angrily protested against, that because Kashmir has been recognized as an international dispute as per a United Nations resolutions, so neither country can change the status of the Kashmir territory. But India changed it in August of 2019. And since then, Pakistan has suspended all kinds of dialogues, whether it's political dialogue or trade-related dialogue or any other conversations at the official level. So the two countries do not have any diplomatic contact for the past 2 years, and that has fueled tensions. And with no dialogue going on between the two countries, there has always been this concern that these tensions could really escalate into some kind of a military conflict between the two countries. And that's why there have been calls internationally for the two countries to resume dialogue. But again, Pakistan has linked a resumption of any dialogue with India to New Delhi going back on the steps it took in August of 2019 that restored the status of Kashmir as per the UN resolution. But India has refused to do so, saying that because Kashmir it's an integral part of India as per Indian officials. So whatever it has done, whether it's changing the status of the Kashmir territory, is an internal matter of India, and no third country or no third power or Pakistan can object to these steps.
Both nations are on military high alert in this particular region. How close are we to another shooting war?
For the last 2 years particularly, both the countries were witnessing military clashes, especially along the Kashmir border. Almost daily clashes were happening, and civilian and military casualties were also taking place. But suddenly what we saw in February of this year, that the military commanders of both the countries, they agreed on a ceasefire in Kashmir. Since early this year, we have not seen any military skirmishes in Kashmir or along their regular border. But obviously, with no dialogue taking place and both the countries share such a long border, there are concerns, and those concerns continue to prevail, that any misunderstanding, like in terms of any terrorist attack on the Indian side, which India always blames on militant groups operating on Pakistani territory, can spark another conflict between the two countries.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. The Indian Army says it fought an infiltration bid by Pakistani militants in northern Uri town of Jammu and Kashmir region and recovered a huge cache of arms and ammunition from them on Tuesday. The operation began late on September 18th and 19th after a patrolling party saw a group of six militants crossing the border. A firefight ensued between the militants and the patrolling party, forcing four militants to retreat towards the Pakistani side, while two militants sneaked into India. Security forces gunned down one while the other surrendered. India accuses the Pakistani army of training and infiltrating militants into Kashmir to stir trouble in the valley. Pakistan denies the charge. This is the Voice of America. Germany's newly elected lawmakers are holding their first meetings as the parties digest the fallout of the election that reduced outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel's bloc to its worst ever result. The lawmakers on Tuesday will start the process of putting together a new government. The narrow winner of Sunday's parliamentary election was the center-left Social Democratic Party of Olaf Scholz. Japan's government says the coronavirus state of emergency will end Thursday so the economy can be reactivated as infections slow. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced that virus restrictions will be eased gradually. With the lifting, Japan will be free of emergency requirements for the first time in more than 6 months. The current state of emergency declared in April was repeatedly extended and expanded. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. 3 weeks ago, VOA brought you the story of Nasria, one of the Americans trapped in Afghanistan after U.S. evacuation efforts ended August 30th. She asked that we use only her first name for her safety. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob has been in touch with her since the evacuation ended and has this update.
25-year-old Californian Nasria came to the Afghan capital in June to visit family and marry her longtime boyfriend. Pregnant and scared after the Taliban takeover, she fled with her husband to the airport, but they never made it in. She filmed herself waving her American passport. But day and night, the Taliban kept blocking her.
I was got a gun pointed to my head. Our troops were literally at the gate, just waiting for us to continue walking. And they had blocked us. And there was a time where, like, I went past them and I started walking as fast as I can. And they started shooting right by my leg and told me to come back or they would shoot me.
When the U.S. military left, Nasria said the Taliban were hunting down Americans.
There's been days where, you know, I think to myself, like, am I going to make it home? Am I going to end up living here? Am I going to end up dying here? What's going to happen?
She hid in a basement for nearly 3 weeks as VOA News and others in and out of government worked around the clock to help. And then, during another one of our calls, she told me about a breakthrough.
So I got a call from the State Department at 3 in the morning, and they told me to go to a Serena Hotel in Kabul at 8 in the morning.
From there, Qatar officials put her on a flight to Doha. But then...
the State Department told me that I had to stay for like a week and a half or two until they can evacuate me from Qatar.
So the veterans group Operation Recovery, who'd been monitoring her case, booked her a flight to Los Angeles just a few days later.
I'm just really excited to be back home, and it feels amazing. It's nice to breathe again, to be honest.
She's seen friends and family since her return, and she says, best of all...
the baby is good. Matter of fact, I went for a checkup, and I got my ultrasound, and I got to hear his little heartbeat, or her little heartbeat. I don't know the gender yet.
Boy or girl, that little one has had an interesting journey already. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
Australia is under growing international pressure to commit to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but the policy is fiercely dividing its centre-right government. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia is one of the world's major exporters of coal and gas. Coal is mined in every Australian state. Most exports go to countries in Asia, including China, Japan and South Korea. In 2020, exports were worth about $39 billion. Trade has almost doubled in the past decade. But China's informal import restrictions on Australian coal saw the value of exports fall sharply, although prices have started to recover. Coal also generates about 70% of Australia's electricity. Coal-fired power makes it the most carbon-polluting nation per capita in the world. Prime Minister Scott Morrison is planning to eventually shift his country's reliance on coal and gas in favour of clean energy technologies, a shift from his time as Treasurer in 2017. In support of the mining industry, then Treasurer Morrison brought a piece of coal to Parliament to argue the need to continue producing coal in a famous scene.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal that has delivered prosperity to Australian businesses and has ensured that Australian industry has been able to remain competitive on a global market.
Clean energy is still an issue that deeply divides his centre-right governing coalition. Some members of the National Party, the Junior Alliance partner, are adamant that Australia's coal industry is too valuable to lose and insist it will thrive for decades. Many regional communities depend on it. There's also disagreement about committing to a target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. The Prime Minister said he wants to achieve net zero emissions as soon as possible, but hasn't outlined any measures to do so. But government lawmaker Trent Zimmerman says Australia must join the global push to reduce emissions.
We need both the target and the plan that matches it. It's very hard to divorce the two. And obviously, much of the international community has moved in that direction. In fact, 80% of global emissions or thereabouts are covered by pledges that relate to reaching net zero. So it is important for Australia that we are part of that because it's the right thing to do.
Morrison has said he's yet to decide whether he will attend the Glasgow Climate Change Conference, known as COP26, in November. He told a newspaper that he wanted to oversee Australia's eventual emergence from COVID-19 lockdowns. His critics insist he's too embarrassed by his government's climate change policies to attend the summit in the Scottish capital. Opinion polls by the Australia Institute, an independent public policy think tank based in Canberra, have shown that most Australians want stronger measures to curb emissions. A United Nations climate change report recently warned that global warming will inflict more severe and frequent drought, storms, heat waves and bushfires in Australia. However, those surveys reported by the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper also revealed support for the coal industry. Less than half of Australians believe that coal power should be phased out within a decade. Australia's addiction to fossil fuels might be hard to give up, according to the survey. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedofo in Washington.